listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-DM, GM, etc.,
Miguel.
And it is the third day of 2024. It's January 3rd, 2024. We are recording the first episode. Well, not the first episode that's going to go up this year, I don't think. But the first episode that we're recording of this year, it is episode 175, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. And I feel like such a fool, Tom. Last episode we recorded, I was making such a big deal about it being the last episode of 2023, and then we just decided to take last week off and not post an episode. So
just didn't seem like the right time. We weren't recording an episode to make up for it, so.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it was that week that everybody takes off between Christmas and New Year's anyhow.
Yeah.
But now we're all screwy. Now our first episode of 2024 will be our last episode of 2023.
Sort of. I mean, it won't, but we said it would.
I mean, but it was the last one we recorded in 2023.
True. Sorry, I see what you mean now. Okay. This is very confusing. Let's get off this topic.
Why do we date these again?
I don't know. Just for the record. You know, so people know
for the record, yeah,
when the episode was recorded.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I guess it is especially pertinent in those earlier episodes when they were taking place, like right at the height of COVID, during that historical sort of swath that we were recording through. So I guess there's value in that, but the end result of that decision is me feeling like a chump. As I edit an episode to be posted in 2024, I'm like, hey, it's still 2023.
Well, I don't mean to make you feel like a chump.
It's okay. I do that to myself plenty.
A whole new operation of Coyote's Aegis to kick off.
Nice. Yeah. What's it called?
The operation.
Yeah.
It was called Operation. Where is it? Operation Riverbed.
Operation Riverbed. Riverbed, I never would have got. I was going in my head. I was going through potential ideas for, you know, there's obviously no real convention or pattern to the names of the ops. We've discussed that in the past, but I was trying to think of what it might be. I never would have gotten Riverbed.
Yep, Operation Riverbed, following Operation Failing Moon. I mean, we just ended the Battle of Ashgrain Outpost. We're following a major military victory here. Of course, we have to follow that one with yet another, because Agaloc is still not yet entirely liberated. I want to get off right in front of it here. We're sort of ahead of it a bit, but you know, as I've mentioned in the past, each of these operations is sort of like based on an existing Adventurers League module. In this case, this act, it was a lot of stuff from the third season of the Adventurers League, which was the Out of the Abyss track. And this operation, the basis for this operation was actually the epic for that season, which is the big, like, multi-part sort of convention-setting designed adventure where there's all these people taking part in a big operation on multiple fronts, and like different tables sort of put up flags to indicate their progress, and those can be used to help to, you know, signal to other tables how the battle is going or whatever. So previously we saw this when I used the second season epic in the previous campaign, Al's Aces, when it was the battle for Mole Master, which then in my game became translated to the battle for the Crimson Tower, that saw the Nightside Eclipse launch, or the Cult of Elemental Evil in its original context, launch an assault on multiple fronts. Like, they had a big cantankerous machine driven by Dwerger. There was an air assault of airships. There was a naval assault. There was an underground assault.
I think this was the first time you used the phrase the whole meat, wasn't it?
This is very possibly the first time I used the phrase the whole meat. That, you know, because I did use the whole meat. You better believe that this time here, I used the whole meat as well.
Heck yeah.
It is, so the basis for this Operation Riverbed is DDEP-3, or let me make sure I've got that right. Yeah,
so
I was
in the
right.
Case of
it's
these...
It's called Blood Above, Blood Below. Sorry, you were saying, Miguel.
In the case of these epics for Adventurers League, the idea is that at a convention, different playgroups will be playing different facets of these big things. So, like, before we were talking about the Crimson Tower assault one and how there's, like, a war machine and then there's an air assault and all that. Is the intention that at a convention, like, one table will be playing the air assault portion, a different table will be playing the war machine portion, and then, you know, sort of based on how each of those groups do, it affects, like, the final phase of the adventure? Am I understanding that right? Is that
how it's
supposed to work?
That's basically how it works. The only thing is that the tables are not one-to-one with the scenario. You could have, like, five tables all doing the air assault. And then you could, because okay. it's a huge thing that, like, anybody's supposed to be able to play in. And the different facets of these operations, like the air assault or the naval assault, they have, or at least in this one, in Blood Above, Blood Below, there are, like, tiers to the different, approaches. And depending what level your character is, you would be fitted into one of those three tiers. Like, so if the, for example, if the, maybe like the land assault with the big machine, maybe that was like meant for like lower level players, but then like the naval assault or the air assault was like for high level players or something like that, then you would come to the game and you would like sit down at a table, but they would like group you based on what your character level was, and you would sort of work together to do this, as far as I know anyway.
Okay, interesting. I've always had an interest in these sorts of, and like maybe this term isn't exactly applicable to what we're talking about, but like these living campaigns, these ideas of like these ongoing stories that are played across different game stores with different groups, but there's like a continuous world in the background kind of thing. And I don't know, I just find it interesting, this idea of like orchestrating these big group games that have like offshoots and stuff like that. This is sort of an interesting thing to me it's always piqued my interest, but at the same time, I've never really wanted to take part because in general, I prefer to play with my friends. It just doesn't appeal to me to sit down and play with a bunch of strangers, you know?
So in the introduction to Blood Above, Blood Below, it says, this adventure is designed for 3 to 7 first to 16th level characters, with each table divided into level ranges by tier of play. Levels 1 to 4 is optimized for 3rd level characters. Levels 5 to 10 is optimized for 8th level characters. Levels 11 to 16 is optimized for 11th level characters. Characters outside this level range cannot participate in the adventure. But yeah, there's a whole system of like flags where if a table accomplishes a certain objective, then the DMs are supposed to be able to look around and see based on the flags what has been successful and what hasn't, and bring in factors based on that.
It's very interesting. It's an interesting way of doing large-scale D&D in a big group setting.
So we're going to... And that's all to just say that, that this is based on Blood Above, Blood Below, designed by Will Doyle, developed and edited by Claire Hoffman, Chris Tulock, and Travis Woodall. I think that the rest of the credits are always the same on these Adventurers League things, but... you know, and a lot of these names come up again. So I don't know. I don't know if I got to give the whole rundown every time. Also, considering that I don't actually use the, I mean, I use the whole meat, but anyway, all this to say that I'm going to be stepping away from the module once again. Just because we're going to some more stuff that isn't so based on the content from the epic. So, having secured victory at the Battle of Ashgrain Outpost, the party receives a sending from Coyote afterwards, inviting them to join the Draelic soldiers in their victory celebrations. After all, they're as deserving of it as the soldiers are. They are hailed as heroes and praised throughout the army, especially by those who bore witness to their mighty deeds on the field. Alongside hundreds of Draelic soldiers, they depart the forest to enjoy their success beyond its boundary. The Draelic line is abuzz with festivity following the victory as the relieved soldiers return from battle. Taking part, the party eventually finds themselves among countless other revelers in a new location of the Golden Dolphin seafood chain that has spread throughout the Deathlands since its liberation. The location has been quickly and cleverly set up to make the most of the army's presence while the invasion of Agaloc is ongoing. Staff of the restaurant are working double time to meet the demands of the many revelers. The mood is uproarious as the drinks flow freely. A group of skilled bards and musicians fills the air with lively music, and the place is festooned with bright lanterns. While the menu may not be impressive to Hexaquila by any means, the diligence of the kitchen under these circumstances is commendable. They wouldn't dare ask Hex to assist on the night of his triumphant battle, master chef though he may be. The party is encouraged to enjoy their night off, same as everyone else. And I ask how did they wish to spend it, and if they wish, they may roll a d10 for carousing results. And Hex and Connor are down to carouse, and Gent says, yeah, me too. I get him to roll some d10 rolls. So.
I love me a D&D party, like a party in game, and... I was wondering if you were going to do some form of dice rolling in the party, because, of course, carousing is one thing, but my temptation is always to include some kind of mini game that they can participate in. You know, there's a big festival going on, and you get to bob for apples, or there's an archery contest, or there's a card game. I always want to throw something like that in.
So the way I did this here is the same way that I would do... Methley's Wild Surges, which is I went to donjon .bin.sh. Yeah. And they have a Wild Surge table and a Wild Surge generator and a carousing generator, and that produce 10 results, I think, that are completely randomized. And so these D10 rolls are then weighed against the 10 results that come out of the generator. So that's a much more random thing than any like table you would usually get. I'm a big fan of the crowding table because it can result in things like a character wakes up and they've got a pet pig. It's never happened, but Hexaquila ended up with his apprentice gunsmith, Sue Robling.
Oh yeah. Whatever happened to Sue Robling?
Still working on the base. They ran into each other pretty recently, I think. And they will see each other again. Don't worry. So, The party wakes the next morning with a mild hangover, each in a cot in a section of the Draelic perimeter encampment not far from the Golden Dolphin from the night before. Their memories of the night vary in blurriness. Connor mostly has memories of gambling the night away with soldiers, discovers that he's about 300 gold pieces richer in the morning. He also has some brief recollections of comforting soldiers who had lost comrades that day, saying words for the fallen, sharing prayers for Paylor, and keeping spirits from falling into despair. Gent remembers picking a series of locks while increasingly intoxicated. Word that they had unlocked the back gate into Ashgrain Outpost has evolved into a legend that they can pick any lock, and to Gent's knowledge, the legend holds following their performance last night. It's not a clear memory, but it's impossible to forget, because as soon as you get up, you begin discovering discarded open locks on the ground throughout the camp everywhere you go. Apparently, a number of fools challenge Gent with a wager, since Gent also finds that they've gained 300 GP. And Jed says, and a fuck ton of locks. And I say, if you want to keep them, you find 14 in total. Finally, Hexaquila is reminded of the previous night's activities when they walk past a makeshift shooting range. A small wooden rail sits propped up on the way to the Golden Dolphin from the camp, and it is surrounded with the glass of shattered bottles. A pile of shell casings some distance ahead of the rail indicates the shooting contest Hex joined in. Thankfully, checking his Apollo, Hex confirms he was smart enough not to use his own precious munitions. Hex also made a profit off his skills in the process. 300 gold worth of wagers and trick shots. To indicate where their gold is at, Gent is currently at 26,104 gold. Gent finds it strange that each of them won 300 gold for a total of 900, like nine toes. Flashback to Stringboard. And then I say, the dangerous number is six fingers. And they go, oh, right. And I say, though in your dreams, the translation was a bit rough at times, since it was sometimes just a bird with an extra talon on each foot. And Alex says, but wait, 900 total minus 300 each. We each didn't get 600 gold. Get that Stringboard back out.
The freaking number 23.
I say Hex also gains a big old egg. And
Tom, can you remind me? I seem to recall you saying that the number 6 wasn't as significant as they were building it up to
be.
No,
it right? was. Gratz has six fingers, so it's the recurring thing. But now they're just breaking down other multiples of 3, seeing if they can get to it. So yeah, Hex also gains a big old egg. Gent laughs at that. Hex says, a big old egg? I say, yep, for cooking. He says, sweet. So, they're given enough time to clear their heads and lose their hangovers with a little extra rest and relaxation before anyone contacts them. Eventually, they receive another sending from Coyote instructing them to return to the Golden Dolphin for a brunch meeting with other MPOC agents and contacts in the area. This time, the kitchens are open to Hexaquila should he wish to step in as guest chef. Hex takes a little time to create some pretty ornate fruit bowls with whatever's on hand, big melon baskets full of cactus fruit, etc. I say...
Aw, not edible arrangements?
The staff of the Golden Dolphin leads the group to a section at the back of the dining area, the long table that their contacts are seated around. They see Abu, a long-standing goblin MPOC agent, seated alongside a familiar-looking dwarf. To their surprise, they are joined by Dimzad, the notorious Dwerger merchant and arms dealer. Hex has had enough dealings with Dimzad to know that Dimzad's arms dealing landed him in hot water with the MPOC at least once previously. Dimzad is enjoying a freshly baked cheese and bacon biscuit when the group arrives and offers a casual salute to Hex. I have everyone roll insight. Also, I'll include pictures for you so we can put in the show notes. So we got Abu.
Hey, looks great.
Again,
where'd this image come from?
Just off the internet. I probably Google searched Goblin Gunslinger of some kind. And then Dimzad is actually one of the Dark Iron Dwarves from World of Warcraft.
Oh, yeah, he's from WoW, you can sort right? of tell. Yeah, that one I recognize.
And then
So is the insight roll about the sausage biscuit?
No. It is about recognizing the third individual at the table. Oops. Who I just sent to you.
Some kind of trekking dwarf.
The familiar-looking dwarf is named Ren. If he looks familiar to Gent, it's because they met his brother, Rod, who passed on the information that Alistair was looking for them when he wanted the group to slay that Illithid. Like his brother, Ren fought alongside Connor and Hex in the Battle of Butchertown back when their team was on caravan duty through the Deathlands. So that third dwarf is Ren. And Abu says, greetings, agents. Please sit down. Is there anything you'd like to start? Biscuits? He glances over at Dimzad. And I said I can provide the menu apart from anything Hex prepares. And Alex says, sure, Hex will peruse the menu.
Was there another NPC called Ren, or was Ren mentioned previously beyond just his brother Rod?
Ren was at the Battle of Butchertown, what I just said.
That's right. Yeah.
I think they were both at the Battle of Butchertown, to be fair. But I think that Rod was like the blacksmith, whereas Ren was just like a local dwarven guard that fought in the battle.
The name rang a bell.
So, the menu for the Golden Dolphin on this occasion. We have appetizers. Deathland salad, which includes scorpion meat, lettuce, tomato, basil pesto, bacon crumble, and a zip of tangy dressing. Fresh baked cheese and bacon biscuits, and garlic shrimp and home fries. For entrees, we got the seafood omelet, the fish and chips.
Jeez, I want that last one. Garlic shrimp and home fries?
The lobster, the seafood risotto, famous seabug sandwich. The seabug sandwich is a mixed crustacean meat on bun with spicy sauce, lettuce, tomato, and hummus. And for beverages, we got goodberry, which is... we have goodberry tea, goodberry juice, or goodberry wine. We have coffee, iced tea, cocoa, spring water, tea, or Catatonian beer. And then I noted that the big egg would be ideal for the omelet. And Hex special requests an omelet with his big egg. Connor has the garlic shrimp and the seafood risotto. And Gent has the biscuits. Abu calls over the waiter and orders a small Deathland salad. Ren orders a coffee. Dimzad wipes his mouth with his napkin and clears his throat before saying, "Good to see you again, Hexakila. I hear you left quite an impression yesterday." The Dwerger smiles. "And Mr. Bloomheart, of course," he nods to Connor. He then looks to Gent. "Ah, but there's been something of a lineup change. I'm not sure we've been acquainted." And, Hex says, wasn't expecting to see you here, but somehow I'm almost not surprised. This is Gent. You two are either going to be best friends or rivals. Gent, this is Dimzad, one of my favorite unsavory characters. Gent is juggling biscuit crumbs into their mouth. From experience, I'd say I'd prefer to not have any enemies in the MPOC, Dimzad smiles. Hex and Connor, you'll remember Ren from Butchertown, I believe. I understand you weren't with the team yet at that point, Gent, Abu explains. Ren nods to Gent. Good to meet you. If I had any doubts about your place on the team, which I didn't, they would have been clearly dispelled after yesterday's battle. He outstretches his hand. Glancing to Hex and Connor with a smile, he says, the rest of you I'm quite familiar with from when you helped save my home. Gent nods and shakes hands. Hard to forget a brother in arms, Connor says with a curt salute. The first round of appetizers and beverages comes quickly. The waiter offers to take their orders. Abu and Ren order the Golden Dolphin's famous sea bug sandwich and goodberry juice. Dimzad orders a seafood omelet with a side of garlic shrimp and home fries with goodberry wine.
A lot of this sounds like the kind of stuff I eat through the summer here.
Ooh,
in PEI.
Ooh, seabug sandwich. I love a good seabug sandwich.
Yeah, delicious seabug sandwich.
With Ashcrane Outpost taken, the invasion comes down to the mantle, Abu begins. The Draelic army will be launching a three-pronged assault on the city as soon as possible. Morgar and Gog are already getting things underway. Our attack on Ash Grain Outpost was successful, but it carries with it both disadvantages and advantages, tactically speaking, Ren says. We have a much better picture of how they operate defensively now, but those defenses are now fully entrenched and alert. We can't jump them the way we did yesterday, hence the three-pronged assault. Ren takes a drink from a cup of coffee. Our end of the assault is Operation Riverbed, Abu says. Dimzad grins. I can't believe I'm being let in on an official MPOC operation, with a mysterious name and everything. That three-pronged assault we keep mentioning? You're going to be taking part in all three prongs, as it were, Abu continues. It's going to be a hell of a ride.
You use the whole meat.
It's going to be a hell of a ride. We're striking by sea, by air, and by land. You'll be operating in that order. Unfortunately, the situation necessitates that the Draelic leadership act with such haste that we haven't had time to produce a dossier for this op. You may want to take notes. Hex pulls out the cookbook he found in the outpost and flips to a mostly blank page. Brunch is served, and the group enjoys their meals while Abu explains the broad strokes of the planned three-prong assault. Maps of Agaloc are passed around the table for reference. The first part is by sea. The Draelic army features a small but competent navy in possession of some remarkable warships. The party got a ride with one of them when they entered Agaloc from the south coast when they investigated the Myconid colony. Unfortunately, the enemy has deployed naval defenses in the form of both ships and defensive rafts. A contingent of undercover MPOC agents will assault the shore while the Draelic fleet makes its approach. The party will be given command of their own small naval vessel suited to a crew of three, a captain, a pilot, and a gunner. Using this vessel, they will join the Draelic fleet in its approach. And now this is a call, this is based on Blood Above, Blood Below. It is the first part of the epic. But what's interesting about that is that the scenario is very different in that, because in the Blood Above, Blood Below Adventurers League epic, the scenario is not actually a naval battle. It is like, it's like a coliseum has been flooded to simulate a naval battle. Do you know that?
Like, so it's not on an actual natural body of water. It's like,
no, it's like in the epic, everybody is basically, so in the epic, the whole thing is that they're launching an assault on three fronts. There's one in the Underdark, or no, there's maybe two in the Underdark. I don't know. The point is that they're fighting in the city of Hillsfar on the surface, and they're fighting in the Underdark simultaneously. And there are there's a demon in each of the scenarios, like, I'm pretty sure it's in Hillsfar, or is it in Hillsfar? I don't think it would be. It's the point is, the players in the first tier of that epic, they are basically let into a huge group of supposedly slaves that are then going to fight in this huge gladiatorial arena with, like, this simulated naval combat. But then they go in with the real purpose of, like, turning the tide of the combat and then eventually drawing the demon into combat and slaying them. But their success is one of the things that is measured with the flags in the epic. But it's also, I just want to say, like, I turned it into a full, like, full-scale naval assault, whereas the actual basis for this is like a weird sort of like contained flooded coliseum fight. One of the sort of like telltale connections there is actually I mentioned that the defenses come in the form of both ships and defensive rafts, but in the coliseum fight there are actually towers sticking out of the water, and like there are sort of like flags on each tower that if the players can, like, take that tower, then they sort of, like, win a victory in the gladiator fight.
All right.
So, Abu provides some veteran insight. We used most of these same ships back when we launched the invasion of Port Ravendusk on the Deathlands, North Coast. There were some tactics similar to the ones you saw yesterday used. Hellhounds deployed to take out entire squads at a time. We would land on the docks and get hit with fire as soon as we got off our ships. The advantage then, though, was that we had docks to land on. The mantle is further inland. They've made a point of making it inaccessible from the coast, or at least discouraging that approach. Dimzag clears his throat loudly. Abu glances at the Dwerger. Don't worry, we've all got details to get to. Let us lay out the overview of the battle before we trouble them with specifics, the goblin says. I'm screwing up here. Dimzag clears his throat loudly. Abu glances at the Dwerger and says, Don't worry, we've all got details to get to. Let us lay out the overview of the battle before we trouble them with specifics, the goblin says. Dimzag rolls his eyes and sighs before returning to his brunch. Dimzag wants to get his part over with. Part two is by air. The party will receive exfiltration via Black Sabbath fighters to take them from the coast to their next objective. To the party's surprise, the Black Sabbath fighters are only for the purpose of picking them up and delivering them. Tree cover is way too thick for the fighters to be used safely or effectively in this battle. Even in the city, the massive trees are part of the defenses, as you'll see.
Are the Black Sabbath fighters piloted by war pigs?
No, they're piloted by goblins, trained by Professor Nesne and Rob Fling, who was the aviator, the sky marshal, or whatever for the MPOC.
Are there, are they multitudinous? Would you say there are masses of them?
Not really. There's not that many, truth be told. They only have so many.
I'm never going to get this proper Sabbath reference out.
Abu explains that rather than Black Sabbath fighters, the party will be taking to the air using cloakers as their mounts. This is another thing from the epic. Once the party is dropped off by the fighters, they will mount these gliding mantle ray-like creatures, which make their home in the deep shadows of the forest. These will allow them to maneuver quickly and stealthily through the forest and slip past enemy patrols to rendezvous with drow allies in the field. The drow know of old drow ruins connected to the Underdark, which the mantle is built on. The party is to assist the drow in infiltrating the city via these ruins. From there, they are to move on to the third and final part of the assault, by land. The fighting will be fiercest in the land assault, with the defenders using platforms up in the trees to provide cover to the allies in the fray below. The drow will provide mounts in the form of giant spiders to aid the party in joining that part of the battle. A gent chokes at giant spider midway through their brunch. Of course, you'll notice that while I've given you the overview of the battle, I haven't covered your specific objectives therein yet, Abu says, finishing his meal. Your turn, Ren. We've learned of two captives being held by the enemy that we want rescued if at all possible. Both male, both elves. One of them is a drow. The first, the one that isn't a drow, is a Draelic noble by the name of Dub. Our spies spotted him being brought aboard a royal flagship of the enemy navy, likely as a hostage. Our drow allies have informed us that Gak, the other captive, is being held in a tower among the mantle's surrounding defenses. It's not a lot to go on, but you'll have the best chance out of anyone in the field to save them, so keep your eyes peeled. Dimzag? Abu looks to the Dwerger. Right, Dimzag begins. So, being in the business I am, I deal with all sorts. Some good, some less good. As a result, I happen to have some contacts which happen to be of the less good sort. Turns out some of these contacts were so far south of good, they heard about a tyrannical racist human kingdom in a haunted forest, and they thought that sounded like a good life. Naturally, they're all human. All four of them. We want these traitors taken alive so that we can find out what they've told our enemy... We want these traitors taken alive so we can find out what they've told our enemies. Luckily for us, they've each been rewarded for their treachery by being given command one of the mantle's defensive rafts, Abu explains. There are three males and one female, the goblin looks to Dimzag. Sheena, Ted, Lug, and Doug, Dimzad says, for whatever that's worth. Hex, or Connor asks, will the Navy pick them up for us, or will we have to store them long term? And they say, since you'll be going in with the Draelic fleet, they'll be on hand to take aboard any prisoners you neutralize. Jen says, good. Of course, these are all minor objectives in comparison to your larger overarching assignment, Abu says. We need you to interrogate the leader of the defenders on each front. That means the one on the royal flagship, whoever leads the defenders against you when you infiltrate the city, and the one commanding the defenders in the main assault. Generally, a field interrogation performed on the spot will do, but in the case of the main assault, we need them captured. And you should know, Abu looks to Gent, our intel suggests that these leaders may in fact be fiends, regardless of outward appearances. Any questions? Abu asks. And Gent says, so rescue two if possible, capture and interrogate four traitors, and lastly interrogate three leaders during a three-pronged assault. And Hex says, plus capture one of the last three, I think. I clarified, you don't need to personally interrogate the traitors, just capture them alive. And Alex is correct. You're charged with interrogating all three leaders, but the last one must be taken in. So, rescue two, capture four traitors, interrogate three leaders, who may be fiends, capture the last leader. And the four traitors will all be during prong one of the assault, as it were, as is the first rescue target. Gent says, okay, easy peasy. And then I made a little checklist for them, which was, for ease of reference, let's say part one by sea. Rescue Draelic Elven Noble, capture Sheena, capture Lug, capture Doug, capture Ted, interrogate the leader. Part two by air, interrogate the leader. Part three by land, rescue the Drow captive, interrogate and capture the leader. That's your checklist. Three-pronged attack, sea, air, land. Hex wrote his own little notes for it. C, advanced ops on shore ahead of naval landing. Enemy ships and defensive rafts. Expect Hellhound landing deterrence. Find Dub on the enemy flagship. Interrogate the leader about the enemy aboard the enemy flagship. Capture three human men and a woman on the defensive rafts. Sheena, Ted, Lug, Doug. Air, exfiltrate via Black Sabbath fighters. City has heavy tree cover, making direct aerial assault impossible. Transfer to cloaker mounts to approach the city stealthily. Expect defensive platforms and trees. Interrogate the leader guarding the city. Land, rendezvous with Drow for access to Underdark and giant spider mounts for tunnel travel. Find Gak in a tower among the mantles surrounding defenses. Capture the enemy leader. Once cooled, gently fold the leak mixture into your dough ball. Jen says, super helpful. And I say, any questions beyond that? And Hex says, did we ever own a boat? Oh, we had a barge, didn't we? And Jen says, I know we had a freighter. And I say, oh, well, back in Citra Akra. And Jen says, barge. And he says, oh, yeah, yeah, I feel like that got left behind. I say, I'm not even sure it was yours so much as you were just making use of it to travel across Citra Akra. I think it was actually on an automated route. You guys wouldn't have known where to go, after all. And Gent says, so like the swan boats at Wonderland. And I say, unless there's any other questions, a field armory and lab has been established so you can get access to vital items without heading all the way back to Omega Base. The party should check in and get any shopping they need done before the next battle. And Gent says, I could buy a boat if I wanted. And Hex says, maybe we should invest. A certain traveling band of adventurers drummed up the money for MPOC's current fleet. Jen says, okay, cool. We need to stock up on potions and healing stuff for sure. Jen can purchase those if available. So I give them access to the armory. Hex and Connor need some ammo. Hex buys two E-cells. Connor picks up three shotgun reloads worth of ammo and five supreme healing potions. And then he's like, nah, let's make it four shotgun reloads. Gent gets 10 supreme healing potions and then gives three to Hex and three to Connor. Hex and Connor will swap potions back and forth in a hilarious prop comedy scene that lasts way too long as they describe their favorite potions and their uses. Gent's new total is 22,104 gold, and they're keeping four of the supreme potions. In the end, Connor has five supreme health potions, a potion of climbing, an invisibility potion, and Hex has six supreme health potions, four health potions, two superior health potions, and an invisibility potion. Connor's gold total is now 8,400. Hex is down to 9,000. With that, they're done. Well, actually, they say they're done, and then I'm like, all right. I'm a little curious as to why nobody buys potions of invulnerability or speed, it seems. Also, the Rod of Rulership currently in the magic item section is maybe worth highlighting for the sake of it. But otherwise, these seem like sound decisions to me. And Alex is like, oh, Connor will rent the Rod of Rulership. That could be super useful. Yeah, the rental is 3,000 gold, but Connor can keep it as long as he needs. Then Connor has a moment. He goes, wait, he'll turn in the Caneth Mandolin in exchange for it? Or had I already turned that in? And I say, Gent currently has the mandolin. Oh, even stranger. I think she actually stole it from Connor in some context. Gent says, I think so. I will produce it when Connor searches all his pockets. You dropped it back there. I just remember that when you got the petrified rabbit, I suggested Gent could demand Connor unpetrify the rabbit in exchange for his magic mandolin back. And Connor goes, oh, terribly clumsy of me. Must have been while I was climbing that trench. And I say, is that delivered with sarcasm? And he says, nope, more embarrassment. So at last, Gent removes the mandolin from her inventory. As for the potions of speed and invulnerability, you can see the reasons why they pass on them. I just wanted to make sure people weren't forgetting or missing them. And to that, Alex says, nah, invulnerability could be good for Hex, but they're just a bit pricier than I'd like, I think. And he says, I mean, it makes sense, but Hex already gets several resistances while raging. I guess it could be used instead of a rage instead of in a prolonged fight. I don't know, not completely sold. I said, or Connor could use one. Says, it's true, he was getting his butt kicked a couple sessions ago. I don't mean to speak for Jen, but I feel like she's rich enough that she'd probably pay to make someone on the team invulnerable for a short period of time. And at that reasoning, Alex says, all right, Connor will buy one potion of invulnerability just in case. Do you know what potion of invulnerability is?
I should. I know I've used it. Invulnerability... I know I've definitely used it in a campaign, but I can't think of its exact effect. Is it gives you like resistance against a whole bunch of stuff?
For 1 minute after you drink this potion, you have resistance to all damage.
Hey, I was right. People resistance to a whole bunch of stuff.
I'm really surprised people, like, maybe they're just super rare, but like, to me, if you're really high level in a game of 5e, you should buy a potion of invulnerability. It's just, like, it makes you so much more survivable in any fight. I don't know. I just, resistance to everything, it's like, I certainly used it on a high-level character in a final confrontation, and I was pretty glad to have it. So, Connor buys one potion of invulnerability just in case. Gent says, I will buy Hex an invulnerability potion. I say, we'll see what Chantel says on her, or sorry, the. And I explained, just because I don't think Chantel was there when I first introduced them, but the potion of speed provides the effects of haste, giving a character more actions and improved defenses for 1 minute. Potion of invulnerability grants resistance to all damage for 1 minute. Gent says, I just never think of items, so see no point in purchasing for me. I'm a creature of habit. And Alex says, it just doesn't make a ton of sense on Hex, I don't think. And I agree with that because of his rage already giving him a lot of resistance. Chantel says, so better to buy for Connor? I have boots of haste. I'm good. And he says, yeah, let's each get Connor one. Probably reduces fall damage too, Hex remarks. So Gent spends 1,000 to get Connor an invulnerability potion. Connor's down to 7,400 now. Jen is at 21,104. And everyone declares they're all good. So, on the understanding that they're all done buying stuff and asking questions, Once they've finished preparing, they must travel through Agaloc on foot to reach the southern coast and meet up with the Draelic fleet. Despite the ominous nature of the forest, the quiet journey provides them with a period of meditation before they must dive once more into the fires of war. Apart from the mantle itself, the forest holds few terrors for them now, apart from the unknown. They enjoy a certain safety as well, thanks to the presence of the Draelic army within Agaloc. They've reached the southern coast feeling refreshed, ready, and clear-headed. On the water, they can see the various ships of the Draelic Navy, all different classes but featuring the advanced design afforded by the Empok's extraplanar resources. The Draelic fleet consists of the Slayer battleship, the Iron Maiden destroyer, the Pantera cruiser, and the Motorhead transport. The last of these is currently being used to move large groups of troops along the southern coastline, but the other more combat-ready vessels will be heading for the Mantle's naval defense grid alongside the party. The ship that they are provided with is much more modest, resembling the landing craft used in the invasion of Port Ravendusk that Abu mentioned. These open-top vessels are designed for swiftness rather than protection. The craft appears sturdy enough, though not remarkably so, but the main feature is clearly the ballista mounted on it. 10 bolts are provided for the weapon, and the ammunition has been prepared such that it can be easily ignited, allowing the ballista to fire flaming shots. For reference, the critical traits for each of the three roles aboard the landing vessel will be: captain uses charisma skill checks, pilot uses intelligence ability checks, whoever is least qualified for the above two should be on gunner duty. Also, I don't know if you have this, but proficiency in water vehicles would be extremely useful to anyone in this situation. So I say, who among ye will fill the roles of captain, pilot, and gunner? And what shall ye name your vessel? And this is all part of the epic. You do get a boat for the Colosseum fight, and you get to choose who does what role, and you get to name it.
Hell yeah. And you know how much I enjoy giving my party a ride, giving them their own vehicle that they get to name and customize.
So, Gent says, I don't have water vehicle proficiency. Pilot is a big note, but perhaps charisma? And Alex says, neither do Connor or Hex. Connor and Hex are both zero in the relevant stats. So, Gent has a laugh. Say, Gent def has the stats to captain, but she also has a +1 int. And Alex says, you take your pick. Hex will blow action surges to double dip, and Connor can cast enhance ability and praise. And Jen says, I will do captain. Better to have a sure thing than a maybe an int. And Alex says, yar, captain. Hex will be pilot. Connor will gun. I say, all right, sounds good. The enhance ability strat is a solid idea. What shall ye name your vessel? And Gent says, Chum Bucket. And Alex says, the Dingo Dinghy. And Gent says, the Dingo Dinghy works. And I say, the Frisky Dingo? And then Alex says, Dingo's Dinghy. Oh, the Frisky Dingo. Empok calling, I'm down for the Frisky Dingo. And I say, unless Gent objects, I'm imagining it'll stick. And Gent says, no objection. I say, deeper cut references. Lost Wages, Barnaby Jones, the Death Rabbit. Your ship, the Frisky Dingo, joins the Draelic fleet, heading for the enemy naval defense grid. The party is glad for their moment of ease earlier upon returning to the chaos of warfare. Madness reigns across the shoreline and beyond as the battle rages throughout the areas surrounding the mantle. Shots fly in all directions on the shore as the defenders are drawn into a shootout with the disguised undercover Empok agents assaulting them. You hear the thunder of battle in the distance. Sunlight sparkles on the water. You make your approach alongside the Slayer, the Iron Maiden, and the Pantera. Up ahead, you see the naval defense grid as it was described to you. You see the royal flagship and the defensive rafts floating in the water. Unfortunately, it will take some time to close the distance for your ship's ballista to be effective against the enemy ships, and you only have 10 shots. Luckily, the Slayer, Iron Maiden, and Pantera can all compensate with their massive guns as they approach. A whirlpool forms in the waters ahead of you. Its source unknown, but you can bet it's magical in nature. The pilot must put their skills to the test in order to weather the maelstrom while minimizing damage to the ship. And Jen says, good luck, Hex. Hex must make an intelligence check. Connor casts enhance ability. Fox is cutting. And to their horror, though, the ship is absolutely racked by the turbulent waters. Hex struggles to maneuver out of the whirlpool. And they make the check again. The ship continues to be torn apart in the maelstrom as they all hold on for dear life. Hex must attempt to make the check again. At last, with intense effort, so he got a 17, then a 17, then an 18. At last, with intense effort, Hex manages to pull free of the current. Unfortunately, it continues to pull you back as you attempt to escape. Hex must make the attempt again, though the ship does not sustain more damage. With an 18 again, with white-knuckle tension, Hex just barely manages to evade the pull of the whirlpool, continuing toward the enemy fleet. One of the rafts is black, and on it sits a mighty trebuchet. The trebuchet sits on a pile of bones with burning braziers and a wooden mantlet surrounding it. The mantlets provide cover to a crew of four who man the trebuchet while a minotaur skeleton looms over them. The trebuchet launches a boulder at your ship. Only a swift and able pilot can reduce the damage it will do upon slamming into your vessel. Gent says, oh, fuck. Alex says, oh, geez, dude. This is another int check, and he only gets a 10. And Gent says, I can't charisma it to death. Say, unfortunately, the boulder strikes your vessel just as you come into range of the enemy naval grid. The vessel cracks in two from the trebuchet strike, sending you all adrift into the water. Smoke fills the air as the battle unfolds, with the Slayer, Iron Maiden, and Pantera all opening fire on the enemy fleet. Moreover, the enemy is firing back flaming shots, many of which are falling short in the water and throwing up plumes of smoke. As you reach the enemy naval grid, you find yourselves amidst a chaos of fire and smoke. Hex has to make another int check and gets a 9. Keeping your heads above water, you soon find yourselves floating in the midst of a violent naval engagement. You manage to clamber aboard the Slayer, but as you are scaling the side of the hull, the ship is directly rammed by an enemy vessel emerging from a cloud of black smoke. The damage to both vessels is substantial. One of them will sink, if not both. Suddenly, a hail of arrows descends on the ship from above, showering the deck and all those on it. Connor's heavy armor protects him from the volley, but Gent and Hex are both hit. Hex takes 17 piercing damage. Gent uses uncanny dodge to take 6 piercing damage from a single arrow that nails them in the back. Considering the rain of arrows, though, that's not much. Hex was less lucky. The heave of the ship at the moment of the volley falling cursed him to stumble, caused him to stumble forward, taking a hail of arrows to the back. Thankfully, he has a tough hide. Not a good day for Hex, though. Hex says, certainly not. At least he pulled you guys out of the whirlpool in time to get to the close. In time to get closer to the enemy. It would have been nastier if you'd been smashed at way out before the engagement. And Alex points out those were actually really good rolls for plus zero, to be fair. And Jen says, "Yeah, like insanely good." And I say, it's chaos on the deck of the Slayer. An enemy lifeboat sinks just out the corner of your eye. Fire and smoke billows up from the front of the ship where the crash occurred. This is the time for an able captain to take charge, either through clear, precise communication or by barking the right orders at appropriate volumes at the right moments. Gent, roll either persuade or intimidate to slice through the confusion. And Connor casts enhance ability, Eagle Splendor on Gent, giving them advantage. So they get a 29 on persuade. Taking charge of the situation, Gent quickly begins coordinating the panic crew of the battleship. Personnel scramble to address the fire at the front of the ship, ensuring that the damages to the enemy vessel outweigh the damages to the Slayer. Meanwhile, Connor sees an opportunity for a clear shot. As he comes into range of the enemy fleet, he has a brief window during which the gunner has a perfect shot lined up as the vessel sweeps past the central defenses. The only question is what to target. 6 enemy vessels sit in range in addition to the rafts, though the guns are not designed to fire at the downward angle the rafts would necessitate, so a shot directed at a raft would need to target something specific on it. The Slayer breaks away from the wreckage at its prow. Connor must make the call quickly. So, he decides to take out the trebuchet on the lead defensive raft. Hex charges below decks and moves to the part of the hull where they've been rammed. He says, what's the damage look like? I say, not as bad now that the crew is dealing with the fire. The prow of the enemy vessel breached the prow of the Slayer, but the Slayer isn't taking on water. It's big and sturdy enough that it could hold its position like this, and even on the move, it would only be slightly walking wounded, as it were. Hex helps out wherever he can. The enemy vessel is sinking into the water, a burning wreck with ruined and capsized lifeboats all around. The Slayer opens fire on the trebuchet raft, and though the salvo is pronounced, the trebuchet is still functional and at least partially standing when the smoke clears. Connor may roll a performance check. He should be trained in this. Unfortunately, Connor's voice is unable to penetrate the fog of war on the deck of the Slayer. He attempts to rally the crew around the effectiveness of the gun's battery fire, but the resilience of the trebuchet is too visually demoralizing for Connor's optimism to sway the crew on board. The enemy vessels within range vary in size. Each one has its name visible on the hull. The smallest of the six is the Royal Dragon. It has no shipboard arms, but carries six soldiers wearing leather armor. After the Royal Dragon are three ships that sit in the middle of the size range on display. The Black Justice, the Divine Revenge, and the Lord's Fortress. The Black Justice is only manned by a pilot and a gunner, and the gunner's ballista appears to be on its last shot. The Divine Revenge and the Lord's Fortress both appear to be have a little more ammunition, but the Divine Revenge features another two-man crew, while the Lord's Fortress has eight soldiers on deck. The last two ships are the largest, the Iron Dawn and the Bloody Fury. The Iron Dawn has a crew of three, same as yours did, while the Bloody Fury has four soldiers on board. Both ships have ballistas with several shots on deck, ready to be loaded. There are five defensive rafts, one of them being the black one with the trebuchet on the pile of bones. The rafts don't bear names, but each one is distinct, since the black raft is apparently commanded by a minotaur skeleton, and there are only four other rafts. You can assume from your intel that each raft other than the black one is under the command of one of the four traitors Dimzad told you about. One of the rafts is a ramshackle iron fort surrounded by dark, murky water with unstable gantries that cling to a central tower where greasy smoke rises from a dozen fire pots. You spot 16 enemy soldiers on the raft. One of these appears to be wearing armor of a better quality than the other, suggesting that he is one of the traitors you were instructed to bring in alive. Jed says, fucker. Another raft is surrounded by choking fumes. Black smoke belches from a giant forge, wreathing this raft in an oily cloud. Suits of armor clank between ironclad towers, attended by a hulking man wearing a suit and blood-covered apron over his fine body armor. Everything on this raft is bloody, spattered with crimson spray, from the platform to the towers to the suits of armor. On one raft sits a tall wooden tower with a ladder leading up to the top, where two chests sit with a sword driven into the wood between them. At the tower's base, a female warrior in bone armor sits astride a giant scorpion. She is presumably Sheena, the lone female listed among the four traitors you were informed of. She is accompanied by five soldiers. Finally, the last raft appears to be a fortress built from rusted metal plates. Toward the top of the fortress, a metal cage imprisons a glowing suit of armor. Nine soldiers defend this raft under a command of a muscular man in body armor that bears the image of a flaming sword on each pauldron. So to summarize, there's six ships, the Royal Dragon, which is small and unarmed, the Black Justice, the Divine Revenge, and the Lord's Fortress, which are all medium with limited ammunition. And then there's the Iron Dawn and the Bloody Fury, which are big and well-armed. Then there are the five rafts. There's the black one with the trebuchet and the minotaur skeleton, the iron one with the fire pots, the bloody one with the smoking forge, the tower one with Sheena on the scorpion, and the rusty one with the suit of armor in the cage. And Jent says, and are we swimming in the wreckage? And I say, no, you're aboard the Slayer, though the Slayer has taken some structural damage to its frontmost point. It is a funny thing there is that I gave them a boat and that was almost immediately destroyed. But hey, they just get on the Slayer. Again, not enough damage to sink the Slayer if it holds its position, but if it moves, there's a chance it might take on some water or risk further damage. Walking wounded, as it were. Jen says, I was thinking taking on the Royal Dragon as it is unarmed and maybe stable. And I say, like trying to hijack it? Jen says, yeah, loot and drive. And Hex says, oh, cool. I say, fuck yeah, you got to start somewhere. I say, as if I didn't fully plan for this eventuality. And that is where we broke.
Right on. R.I.P. the Frisky Dingo.
I was literally just about to say in the Discord here, we're all talking about like, okay, good game and everything, and then I say, R.I.P. Frisky Dingo, unjustly canceled.
Yep. I guess that is appropriate, isn't it?
Alex says, maybe Connor needs to get that mandolin back so he can play sad ocean dirges about the wreck of the Frisky Dingo. And then Gent says, cannot believe we had a boat for all of a minute. I say, Gent's people aren't called Bone Song Kenku for nothing. They have strong musical traditions. And Gent says, I'm going to steal everyone else's.
At least it was a good minute.
And yeah, so I say hell yes to the idea of Gent stealing everyone else's boats. Alex says, yeah, maybe we should have requested like Abu to drive us in or something. But next time we pick up with their boarding action against the Royal Dragon. And the next session actually takes place on my birthday in 2021, oh, wow. 3 years ago.
God, it is 3 years ago now.
Ship heist. So, yeah.
Cool. I can't wait to see what the next phase of the epic is.
Yeah, what did you think of that opening? The briefing and everything. The Golden Dolphin, the naval assault, all that.
Thought it was all really cool, but after all that talk about, like, you know, sea bug sandwiches and all that, got me to thinking... It should be a Coyote's Aegis or maybe just a Drail cookbook, you know, supplemental, the Drail cookbook.
I mean, I don't know how to cook any of the things that I put, but I could put lists of food.
Well, exactly. I mean, I know how to make like a cheesy biscuit. I could definitely make like a bacon cheese biscuit. Sounds good. And didn't one of your NPCs talk about how you do it? Didn't he say something like... What? No. No?
Didn't he say something like what?
Well, I'm trying to think. I seem to recall some line of dialogue when he was talking about the food, about how you like how you make the dough or something like that.
Oh, Alex, when he did his rundown of the three-pronged attack, he ended it with, "What's cool? Gently fold the leek mixture into your dough ball."
Exactly. Alex is a exactly. That's just it, right? Is he said that, and I was like, man, I could make that.
You could make a three-pronged assault with dough ball and leek.
No, I could just make a dough ball that has leek folded into it.
Yeah.
But I could definitely make like a sausage biscuit. Absolutely. I've made a cheese biscuit. Just add sausage, man. Anyway, all that to say, I want the cookbook of Drail.
You want everything. You want the wiki of Drail. You want everything. You want the Drail merch.
The wiki of Drail could have the recipes in it.
If there were any character in the Drail, like in the Drail or MPOC continuity that you could have an action figure of, who would it be?
Oh, man. See, this is why I need the wiki. Tom, I can't remember them all.
I'll tell you who's the obvious pick for me.
Who?
Gut Bones.
Gut Bones, of course.
Press a little button on his back and his ribcage flies open.
Blech. Blech. I'd take miniatures of the main party.
Yeah? Yeah? Sure. Which one? Which of your parties is favorite? Is your favorite the MPOC's Finest, the Owl's Aces, or Coyote's Aegis?
I'm gonna say Coyote's Aegis, but I feel like it's just because I've spent the most time with them.
It's interesting. I guess that makes sense. Like you've heard the most banter of Coyote's Aegis because I've had the transcript.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Chaos Aegis is a bit tricky, though, because the lineup changed over the course of the campaign. Whereas Empok's Finest and Alzace's, you've got, like, a set group through the whole thing.
Also, just give me the full set, man. The full
series
lineup.
Series 1,
why not?
2, and 3.
This yes, exactly. And then the bonus, the little bonus figure.
Oh, man, who would the bonus figure be? You know who the bonus
figure... from the change-up. Or I guess the bonus figures would be to get a set with, like, Al and Coyote and all that,
yeah,
right?
I was going to say the bonus figure would probably be Greasel, the retired teleportation goblin.
I like that. Anyway, Drail merch. Tom will be producing a wide range of it available through our website.
That'd be wild.
Just get yourself a 3D printer.
My dad has one.
Oh, then just get Grant on board.
Oh, yeah. He can do them?
Yeah, Grant can design in 3D.
Oh, my God. I could get him to do Malagasts for me.
Oh, very true.
Although the, you know, 3D printing is really hard. My dad, like, he works on it a lot, and, like, you know, the way I hear it is, like, you get it all set up and it works once and you're like, yeah, I finally got it. And then you do it again and it completely fucks up.
Yeah, I don't have any experience with it myself. But I've been curious.
My dad printed off a few little minis for a friend of mine for their Warhammer army that I gave them for their birthday.
Cool.
But it does take a few tries.
That's wicked, though. You got a piece of, like, Star Trek tech in your house, dude.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
So I got a few topics to cover, one of which you just mentioned, yeah, which is Magna Gothica Malagast.
I was kind of setting us up for a segue there.
Yeah, but there is actually there's a news story that just popped up in my feed today that I feel the need to just shout out. No need to dwell on it, but it is notable, notable games news, which is the co-creator of Warhammer, Brian Ansel, died.
Oh, okay.
Founder of Citadel Miniatures. I mean, I'm not a big Warhammer guy. I used to play it. Played it when I was in, like, junior high. Maybe early high school, but didn't stick with it. I had a small orc army. But yeah, I mean, that's significant. Warhammer is a pretty significant games property when it comes to, like, miniature games and RPGs, of course, and video games. So
I mean,
RIP Brian Ansel.
Warhammer,
I guess,
just got its first ever CRPG. Rogue Trader came out, so for the first time you can role play in the 40k universe in a video game.
It's pretty neat. And I was reading in the article on Brian Ansel's death that they just revealed the launch lineup for Fantasy Warhammer's reboot.
Yeah, old world.
Warhammer
is back.
The Old World.
Fantasy
Warhammer was, yeah, Fantasy Warhammer though was the one that Brian Ansel worked on specifically. So, I guess his legacy lives on even today. But yeah, let's talk about Malagast though. You and I have been playing a bunch of Magna Gothica Malagast.
Sure.
Game I covered by Tom Bloom. Miniature skirmishes in a city on the edge of hell between different necromantic houses, each of which have sort of just cool themed figures and units, and each one even has its own personal heavy metal soundtrack. We talked about it on the show, of course. And now we've actually been playing it, and I'm loving it, man. It's so cool. Really digging it.
Yeah, it's a fun game. I particularly like all the houses and whatnot, all the different units and whatnot. It's definitely Well, the thing that's interesting is that we started off playing it as intended, doing just like little skirmishes, but now I'm running a little campaign of it for you, where I have you going up against sort of like asymmetrical forces in sort of scenarios.
Yeah, scenarios with sort of a lightly connected story that flows between them. I think of it very much like the games of HorrorClix that you and I would play,
Yeah,
where
there's a lot of.
just like several boards of different enemies with different board layouts all adding up to a story.
Yeah, definitely same idea I was going for there.
But I also really dug the little skirmishes we did, especially once, initially we were doing those little single board skirmishes, and you just kept on making these armies that were all thralls, all the lowest level units. It's like
Thrall,
playing chess with
brawl, all
only
thrall.
it's like playing chess with only pawns and a king. Or I guess the necromancer figure is pretty powerful, so maybe only pawns and a queen. And those were fun, but I'd still love to place once at the very end of that, once you started like really mixing it up and bringing in different units besides just the low level thralls, then it got really interesting for me. I can see that it's one of those games where it's pretty simple to learn. Like all of the roles and hazards and everything are really just like, you lose one, or you lose one health, or you gain one health. You do one extra damage, or you're vulnerable to one extra damage, or you need to step onto an elevated platform while it takes one extra movement. It's all just sort of like up one or up down. Maybe occasionally it'll be like add a die or remove a die from your pool, but the simplicity of the mechanics, I think, makes it great to play, makes it really fast and really easy to learn. But there's obviously like a level beyond that of strategizing, just like, picking your units depending on who you're going up against and what kind of terrain the board has. Like, you demonstrated this perfectly. I was playing one of our skirmishes as the Carcass, the private military necromancers, good at a range. And you specifically picked Dead Souls. And populate when we were setting up the board, you put a whole bunch of walls down because your dead souls can use walls, and those walls, of course, would block all my attacks. And so suddenly the tide turned, and I was kind of at your mercy for a while.
Yeah, but then you killed my necromancer because I done goofed and brought my necromancer out too far.
Yes. But all that to say, like, I think it's a really well put together game. I think it nails a sweet spot between simplicity and complexity, and it's easy to learn and easy to play. I like how quickly a game can go, but I also like that we can sort of slow down and really think through our moves. Like, it's versatile in that way. And of course, the flavor of it remains awesome. You and I set up a Discord bot to play music while we play the game. You put together a huge playlist of metal music, and just the whole package combined is awesome. Especially playing it on Tabletop Simulator. Of course, people have created mods, Steam Workshop mods for Tabletop Simulator, so it's all just set up very easily too. Quite fast to get into it. So I give Malagast a big thumbs up. I can't wait till we play again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was looking for. Oh yeah. Someone made a micro tabletop RPG based on Magna Gothica Malagast, sort of, on the Magna Gothica Malagast Reddit. It's called Death and Dishonor. An ultra minimalist TTRPG set in the world of Magna Gothica Malagast based on lasers and feelings. This is from user okay underscore enthusiasm underscore 8072. And I'm only really bringing this up just because I like the idea of Magna Gothica Malagast RPG.
Oh, is it just like a little one pager?
Yeah.
create an adventure, roll or choose below a threat. Hey, let's do this. Grab your D6. You got a D6?
Yeah, okay.
All right, roll it up.
Okay. Six.
So, a cult wants to roll again.
Six.
Let's say cleanse, the option for sixes. Pacifier cleanse. Another one, please. Okay.
Three.
A collection of souls, which will... And one more.
Two.
So the plot of this adventure is that a cult wants to cleanse a collection of souls, which will summon a devil. Play to find out how the players defeat the threat. Introduce the threat by showing evidence of its recent badness. Call for a roll when the situation is uncertain. Don't pre-plan outcomes. Let the chips fall where they may. Use failures to push the action forward. The situation always changes after a roll, for good or ill. Cool. That seems fun. I do think, you know, for all that I praise the gameplay of Malagast, which I do think is awesome, I do think the best thing, the standout feature of the game, is absolutely the lore. Like the world, the necromantic houses, just the look of the units, all the art in the book. I love all of it. It's very, very inspiring, I think. It inspires a lot of different cool ideas. And man, do we have like another comparable... I guess RPG or like tactical game like this that is so rooted in like heavy metal, you know, like
we covered
Mork Borg, but is that like heavy metal? It just kind of feels like its own thing with a heavy metal soundtrack. Like it's got a kind of a heavy metal style, but this one, like, because each house even has its specific heavy metal bands, it's like the vibe, the type of metal for each of the different factions is customized and personalized. I don't know. For some reason, this one feels a lot more in tune with heavy metal music than Mork Borg. Mork Borg is like, you know, it's sort of the tropes of heavy metal lore, and then you just play whatever music you want, I guess.
I mean, we could always check out Gods of Metal Ragnarok.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Maybe we will have to do that. As an aside, you know, you mentioned Mork Borg. I sent you the link. I was browsing through the Steam Workshop for a directory for Tabletop Simulator just to see what other fun, popular games have popped up on there. And somebody made Mork Borgopoly.
Yeah.
Which I think is pretty funny. But yeah, like all that to say, really digging Malagast, and I love the full package. Great lore, awesome look, great art, just cool units. I love how the game plays. I'm way into it. Big thumbs up for Malagast. Grab it on itch.io for the low price of $6.66, and then download the free Tabletop Simulator package and get playing. Speaking of other tactical RPG stuff, CRPGs, you mentioned the Warhammer CRPG. Well, I've been playing a CRPG. I've been playing Baldur's Gate 3. I got it for Christmas, and I just fired it up yesterday and made my character. Playing a human druid. And I'm still very early in the game, so I don't think anything I can say at this point really spoils anything. I'll remain light on details. Do you know like anything about the story or like the beginning of the game?
About Baldur's Gate 3?
Yeah.
I know some things about it, but I've generally tried to be pretty like not paying attention to it.
All right. Well, I'll be light on details then. I will say this game is going to eat up all my time. It is all right. Like I haven't gotten past the first map that you land on, after the like introductory part of the adventure. I'm still very early on in the game, and like I played for like 2.5 hours today. So there's a lot of thinking, planning, and in the tradition of old Baldur's Gate, save scumming. Boy, do you have to save scum in this game. Hitting that quick save all the time. But the setup for the whole story, I was delighted to discover, is reminiscent of an adventure that I ran in my Forgotten Realms campaign. Back, I want to say like, you know, maybe halfway through it between when I started it and now, but before Baldur's Gate 3 had come out. It's kind of similar to the Writhing Obelisk adventure that I ran, where the Illithids attack Waterdeep in a big floating ship. Well, in this one, Baldur's Gate is being attacked by Mind Flayers in a big ship. That's all I will say. But I was delighted.
Wait,
when...
Wait, what? Who? What was attacking Waterdeep in the big ship?
It was Aboleths.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it was a bunch of Aboleths in the writhing obelisk, I want to say. The Writhing Obelisk. It's somewhere in our podcast history. But I ran an adventure based on a module where the Aboleth sovereignty, Zifu, this big floating obelisk, appears over Waterdeep and starts attacking. And there's a very similar setup at the very, very, very beginning of Baldur's Gate 3 with an Illithid in a ship attacking the city of Baldur's Gate. And I was just so delighted to see it because I was like, man, oh man, I know all my players are playing this game. And it must have just been a fun experience for them to like start playing the game and be like, oh my God, I've been in this kind of situation. I roleplayed this kind of situation. So more delight. I'm pretty sure at some point on the podcast, I must have mentioned how, yeah, it was when we were talking about our favorite D&D settings from that list I'd brought. But like one of the reasons I love Forgotten Realms is that it is so built out and has existed for so long that, you know, my players can play Baldur's Gate 3 and recognize stuff from the D&D campaign that they're playing. And I feel like there's some real value in having that overlap where it's familiar to them. So it feels like the same world. The game itself is really fun. Very classic Baldur's Gate with quality of life updates and upgraded to 5e, of course. I really love that they actually make you roll a d20 when you're doing a check. And I can already see a lot of places in the game where I'll want to play through again with a different character, with a different, you know, different stats, different skill set, just so I can, you know, succeed on the investigate role that I failed with my current character. Fail an investigate role, and the little game narrator goes like, you know, you only see what, you know, what appears before you. Nothing unusual meets your eye. And then I'm like, I'm going to play someone who can see really well next time, and I'll figure out what hidden detail is actually there. So, Baldur's Gate 3. I'm going to be playing it for a while. It's a lot of fun. Very much in keeping with the tradition of the old games. And, you know, made me want to go back and play some of those old ones. You know, I never played Icewind Dale or Icewind Dale 2. I hear those ones are pretty good, especially Part 2. So maybe sometime this year when I'm through with Baldur's Gate 3, I'll go way, way back and play those games.
Yeah, you know, the fun thing, this is just something that I was thinking about, and it's funny to me, is like, because now we got Warhammer 40,000 CRPG, we got Rogue Trader, but, yeah. You know, big thing with all these games, you got your companions, but you got your romance paths, your romance for the companions, romance and companions, and Rogue Trader has companion romance in it, which means that in the grim darkness of the future, there is not only war. There's also love.
Warhammer romance.
Yeah.
is a hell of a thing to contemplate.
You can find out all about it on YouTube right now. How to romance different characters in Rogue Trader.
Boy, oh boy. And, hey, you in the mood for a quick jaunt over to the Danger Room?
Oh, geez, I feel like we're taking a lot of time, but sure.
Nah, this is gonna be a really quick one, don't you worry.
Not me!
Not me!
Not me.
So for Christmas, I bought Tom some RPGs.
Yeah.
What RPGs did I get you, Tom?
Got me Extreme Meat Punks Forever,
Hell
Gozer,
yeah.
And Scrap.
Yep. That's right, and you better believe we're going to be talking about Extreme Meat Punks Forever on this show for sure. But because we're... like you said, you know, a little tight on time, I figured I'd talk about Scrap, which I also have a copy of here. And this one's only it's a 5-page RPG off of itch.io. I just sort of chucked this one on top of your RPG bundle for fun. Because it's very high rated. It's among the high rated solo RPGs on itch.io. And this is by, it's called Scrap, and it's by... I don't know if it's Odd Gob or maybe it's Odd Job, but with a G. I think it's Odd Gob. A 20 to 30 minute solo game where you explore a wasteland scavenging for scrap to sell at the next settlement. Along the way, you'll fill in a small hex map, avoid the night goblin, and be up to your neck in scrap. I played this today. I got my sheet right here, my character sheet with my little hex maps on it. This is not an RPG, I would say. And it's not, it's definitely not like a journaling game, like something like Notorious. This is just like a straight up dice game, and you're very much a slave to the random number generator in this one. Like, this is just for fun, roll some dice, write down some icons, and see... what high score you can get. And something that I thought was pretty fun is the game like really encourages you to post your high score sheets. People in the comments on itch.io are posting their score sheets, and it's pretty cool. It's pretty fun. Adds like a sort of a community scoreboard element to it. Try to get the highest score. Odd Gob, who made the game, said his personal high score is 89. So there's something you can try to beat. My personal high score is a measly 19.
So far.
And that's after... so far. It's after two runs. The gameplay loop is very straightforward. You explore. You roll on some tables to determine an event and its outcome. And then you roll on a table to determine how much scrap you get from that little excursion. And each exploration event marks a day, and your objective is to get to the sixth day, like survive to the sixth day, and then you add up all the scrap you get, and that creates your score. And there are a lot of hitches that can hold you back, but the one that might get you between days is the night goblin. So after each day, you
There's
have to roll
here.
On another table.
It says, after encountering the night goblin...
Goldman, yeah, there are a few typos. The reason for that, I should have noted earlier, is that Scrap was created in a self-imposed 24-hour game jam. Odd Gob wanted to see if they could make an RPG in a single day. And this is what they, or a game, I suppose, in a single day. And this is what they came up with. So just sort of like a, you know, kind of put together quickly, but it plays okay. Each day, you're supposed to make it to the sixth day. Each day on your sheet is represented by a hexagon with three squares next to it. So the way it works is first you roll on the exploration table, which is a d6 table. wherever you wind up. Here, roll that D6, Tom. Let's see where we're going.
Oh, jeez. Where am I? 2.
So we're going to the sludge stream. And roll 1d6 again.
Okay. 5.
Cool. So because it's an odd number, you get +1 scrap. And then there's a little icon that is, if you didn't get an odd number, if you didn't get +1 scrap, you put a little 0. Because you got +1, you put a little +1. And sludge stream, there are a couple of sample hexagon representations of it. And this looked like a stream going through a landscape. So the idea is that when you roll the sludge stream in the hexagon for that day, you draw the little icon representing the sludge stream in the hexagon. And then in the first box, you put the icon, so a +1 to remind you that you got +1 scrap. Roll another D6, Tom.
Oh. 5.
5. There's a fallen scrapper. So roll that D6 again.
Oh boy, hope we get odd. 5.
Nice. So you get +1d6 of scrap. So, so far, you're going to, well, how much, you get +1 and then plus another d6 of scrap. Okay, so you get +2 scrap on this. The icon for it is a little sad face for the fallen scrapper. And then finally, the outcome. So roll 1d6.
Okay. 6.
6, amazing. It's an abundant sludge stream. You get 2 scrap rolls, and so the icon for that is x2. So your little day tracker here would look like the hexagon with the sludge stream in it, and then a +1 in the first box, a sad face in the second box, and a x2 in the third box. And then once you've done that, you would roll on the sludge stream scrap table twice. You would roll that because you got the x2 multiplier.
3 and a 5.
So you get 2 sludge weeds, but then you get an additional 2 because of those bonuses. So you walk away with 4 sludge weeds. Each sludge weed has a value of 2 for your score. The score icon is like a little, I don't know what it is. It's like a little letter G that's called bristly for some reason. Like a funny little icon.
Like a thorny vine.
Yeah, like a thorny vine. And, so on your sheet, you would note down in your scrap bag that you have sludge weed, 4 times 2 score, 2 scrap. And so that's your encounter for the day. So it means you just added 8 to your score, which is better in a single day than I have ever gotten in my games. The most I've gotten has been 6 in a single scrap. And that's the day. And then on the first day, on the first day, you don't have to roll for the night goblin because the trigger for it is after each day, you roll 1d6 and the result must meet or exceed the current number of days. So day 1, no night goblin. But as the game goes on, the longer it goes on, the more likely you are to encounter the night goblin. And the night goblin will show up and take down your HP or maybe steal some of your scrap. I encountered the night goblin twice in the game that I won. The first time it ignored me because it thought I was smelly.
Nice.
Which makes sense because I had just come through the rotted ruins and the sludge stream. And then the second time, the night goblin was stabby and stabbed me for 1 HP. I was already down 1 HP thanks to an encounter with some sludge hounds. So I ended the game. You have 3 health points, and I ended the game with only 1 health point left over after all of my encounters with various raiders. There was a shadow beast in there, sludge hounds, etc., etc. And my final bag had old cloth, sludge weed, rotted redfin, and Nyman antlers in it. And I got a total final score of 19. So having played through this, it's very quick and was kind of fun, but I will say the big drawback to scrap is that you are totally at the mercy of the dice, the random number generator. The first time I played, like I said, I only made it to day two. So on day one, I started in the wretched Wart Woods, and I encountered a raider. Because it was my first day, I didn't even have any scrap yet. So he immediately took me down 2 HP. And then I got some wartwood and wartworms. And then the second place I went was the Putrid Plains. And what did I encounter right away? I encountered a dupe glitch, plus one of any... Oh, right. So actually what happened was I had a dupe glitch, which gave me plus one of any own scrap. But then the outcome of the dupe glitch was I was trapped, which was minus one HP. So it just killed me.
Oh, no.
Right,
you got dupe glitched into some terrain and you couldn't get out.
That's right. I got clipped. So... that is really my only complaint about this, is that the dice rolls, you can wind up dead pretty quickly. I feel like it doesn't have enough ways of gaining one HP. It seems like the main way to gain HP is just to, you know, luck of the roll. You roll a six and wind up at the Moonshrine Megalith. So that is the downside. It's like you're purely at the mercy of the dice. But... it's got some flavor, and I really, at the end of the game that I won, I do really like looking at my little hex map here with the different locations and all the iconography. It's a cool little artifact that you wind up with at the end of every game. And Oddgob on the itch.io page also mentions omitted ideas that might be added if there's large interest. Still could happen. This came out in April of 2023, so it's still fairly recent. You know, within a year old. And I feel like these would enhance it a lot. Oddgob says, daily mutations where you gain rerolls, armor, loot roll buffs, and things like that. Collectibles or achievements, ways to track certain outcomes and events. For example, collecting 3 lunar fragments unlocks something. And a wandering trader offering healing services, help navigating, etc. in exchange for scrap. I think that is the one that... of all of these, that's the one that is kind of essential. If there was some way to trade my scrap for HP, that would very quickly remedy the problem that I had where I just died because I rolled badly twice very early on. If I could have given up my worm warts, my wartwood or my wartworms, and healed myself, I could have persisted. And I think that, you know, like... if I play this again, I might just mentally do that, where I say, like, you can trade X amount of scrap for X amount of health, because I think that's a good balance, right? You're losing out on your score, but you get to keep playing the game.
Yeah, you're sort of, you know, rolling the bones, putting your wager mm-hmm. down.
Yeah, exactly. But that is Scrap, a quick solo hex crawl for high scores, available on itch.io, created by Oddgob. It's a name your own price download, so it's right up there. You can download it for free if you wanna. And it's okay. It's not bad. What do you think of this one, Tom? It was, like I said, it was just kind of like an additional, like, hey, that's fun. Chuck it on top of Tom's present.
I'll be honest, like, finding out that it's not really like a journaling thing, like Notorious kind of is a bit disappointing to me. But I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. It seems like a neat game.
Yeah, and as I mentioned before, I really like the community aspect of it. It's cool seeing people's sheets, like here, check this out.
Oh, neato.
I like the little icons, you know? Like the little drawings of the different locations.
This person was playing with Christmas rules.
Oh yeah, sugar glass window wrapped gifts and snow cones. That's fun.
I think their name is Jangle Number 5.
just for fun, create a secular Christmas version with all the same mechanics. Scrap values, just different names. The Night Goblin is the Grinch. Haha. That's pretty cool. This is another, I mean, maybe this is just true of a lot of like itch.io games like Scrap or Malagest, but there is this community facet where it seems like they very openly invite you to do your own sort of thing with it, build off of what's in there and just create something new, similar to what we've done with Malagast, where now we're doing like a mini campaign and scenarios, and then that guy on the subreddit made a one-page RPG out of it. I like that aspect of these itch.io games where it's like a small group of players and they get to chuck in their own ideas. And that's Scrap.
All right. Well, is that our episode?
Sure is.
This has been episode 175, recorded on the 3rd of January 2024. If you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes, or follow us, check us out on Facebook, Compare and Campaign on Facebook. Or if you want to see our supplemental material and show notes, check us out on compareandcampaign.wordpress.com.
That's right. It's all there.
Yeah. Big ups to McGill for doing that.
Yeah, we're back, baby. We've made it back to the present.
We did it. Back to the present. Good night, everybody.